You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 191.
On today's show, we talk about a 1-million-year-old human skull, an ancient board game, and textile production by Viking women.
Let's dig a little deeper. But not so deep that radiocarbon dating doesn't work anymore. All right. Welcome to the show, everyone. How's it going?
Good. Good. We are here in, gosh, what is the name of this town? Springdale?
I think. Zion National Park.
In the campground at Zion National Park.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. We were just in, I say just, but a few months ago, we were in Banff National Park up in Canada. And then we were in Glacier National Park, and the geology was striking. And this is as well, but in a really, really different way.
Very different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything is red and orange and just such gorgeous colors here. We did the Narrows hike, which, I mean, I'd heard of it before, but I didn't really know exactly what it was. But basically, you just like hike a river. You hike down a river.
Through a narrow canyon.
Through a narrow canyon, yeah. You're in a slot canyon and the walls are just like raising up above you. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, we've got a news episode for you. We did a couple special type episodes. We did the one with Glacier, and thanks to everybody that reached out that really liked that episode. And we also did a few interviews in the last couple of months. And actually, I don't know why, but I'm just getting, maybe it's book publishing season or something, but I'm getting reached out to by a number of people that have something to promote book-wise.
Yeah.
And they want to talk about it on the show. So we've got a few more interviews scheduled to record as well.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff. So like, we don't want to say no, but it means that we have a lot of interviews in the calendar, which is good. But what it meant for today is that we went looking for news content, and there's so much out there we almost like couldn't narrow it down. I feel like we need to do like at least two news episodes in a row to cover some of the really cool stuff that has come out lately.
Right. So this first one, and they're all over the map a little bit, but this first one is actually in the realm of paleoanthropology, which possibly some exciting news coming up on that front with a partnership we can't announce just yet, but we're looking forward to some things around that space. I've said this on numerous podcasts. I love paleoanthropology and I want a paleo podcast. So that's not coming down the line just yet, but some other stuff maybe. So we'll talk about that later. But either way, this is about a supposed million-year-old skull found in China, and they're saying it helps fill in a little bit of a hole in the human evolutionary gap. So let's just give you the particulars here a little bit. So it was found in the Hubei province in China, and they say it's one of the most complete human skulls of that age ever seen in mainland Eurasia. And let's just pause right there for a minute. So like million-year-old human skulls, what they're doing here, anatomically modern humans, which is what we are, there's evidence going back, give or take, 300,000 years for anatomically modern humans.
Right.
Anatomically, Homo sapiens sapiens is the term, or the genus and species. Now, you go back a million years, 1.2, 1.3, 1.5, you're talking Homo erectus, which is a different species. But you're also kind of starting to get up into archaic Homo or archaic humans. And they're sort of using the difference between archaic humans and Homo erectus somewhat interchangeably here. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're saying this kind of fills in a gap, because it fills in a hole in a time period where we didn't really have something, you know, and that's at about a million years.
Yeah, like we had fossils on either side of it, but then there's a long chunk of time where we didn't have one. And I think they kind of assumed it sort of continued on the trajectory between A and C. And we just didn't have that B example yet in between them. And now this is sort of what that is.
Which is pretty much the same of literally every paleoanthropological
find. They all fill in some gap. It might be smaller or bigger depending on where it's filling in. But
And you might think, well, why does every fossil found, you know, from a million years plus dramatically alter our mm-hmm. family tree, so to speak. Well, the reason is because we don't have a lot of examples of this stuff.
Right.
And it was really tough. The circumstances had to be really special for something to not only fossilize, but fossilize without distortion, which is one thing this one did. Because mm-hmm. there were two other skulls of similar age yeah. found in the same area 30 years ago, but mm-hmm. they were heavily distorted.
Yeah.
Because when something's becoming stone, it doesn't often hold its shape.
Yeah. It gets compacted almost
yeah.
in the petrification process. Right. And you lose the features and the characteristics that tell you what species it was.
Right. And other things, which they're going to do. We're mm-hmm. going to talk about here in a minute.
Yep.
So, yeah, like I said, there's no visible distortion on this find. But again, back to why every single one of these is special is because those circumstances are so rare. Mm-hmm. And there were actually way fewer people back then, too.
Yeah.
So it's like almost everything we find is a unique specimen.
Yeah. It's truly
we don't
like,
find whole populations.
It's a stars aligning situation, yeah. which I'm not normally a big fan of that analogy. Yeah. But like it really is yeah. in this scenario because everything has to be perfect in order for it to get preserved in a way that it can provide information right. to us as future researchers.
And this thing must be really caked in where access must be difficult because they've only found or recovered, I should say, a frontal bone, orbit, which is like your eye socket, and some other smaller parts of the head that they all know this is from one individual. Mm-hmm. But that's all that's been unearthed so far. The team hopes to get the rest out by November of this year.
Yeah, it's a complete skull, and it's yeah. still in situ when you look at the pictures of it.
Well, they think it's complete.
Well, they hope so. They're hoping to pull the rest of the yeah. non-petrified skull rock that's around it away. Mm. But I guess it must be a really painstaking process. I mean, you have a little bit more experience with pulling fossilized stone artifacts out of the ground from around the rock that they're in, right? Like, is that like yeah. really hard and difficult?
I mean, when I worked in Olduvai Gorge, the sediments we were working in were around 1.8 million years old mm-hmm. and 1.8 to 1.9, give or take. And we didn't find any human material or Homo mm-hmm. material at that time. And perhaps later on they did, but nothing yeah. came out in the excavation. And I say that because, you know, there were large chunks of stuff that just like we didn't break apart and screen because you really can't tell the difference a lot of times between rock and like other rock because mm-hmm. that's all fossilization yeah. is. It turns yeah. it into rock.
Right.
So sometimes whole structures were taken back to the lab and it takes years sometimes to break
to
that
just
stuff
break
apart.
It apart. Yeah.
yeah. So
crazy.
But we did find extinct hippo femurs mm-hmm. and a lot of crocodile mm-hmm. and I can't remember what else we found. But and then those things, again, the way you find them, they really just when you're pickaxing through this rock, you might damage something. There's just no way around that. Mm-hmm. But when you're pickaxing around it and you're just like leveraging stuff out, if it fossilized well, it's still going to have some smooth surfaces. And those smooth surfaces are typically where the matrix breaks away
right.
naturally.
At a fracture
then
point.
You stop the minute you see that smooth thing.
Yeah.
Or something that looks like a shape. Mm-hmm. It might still just be a rock, but mm-hmm. something that looks like a shape. And then you get really detailed with it.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I guess it's not that much different with archaeology through soil, too. It's,
yeah.
The artifacts are usually smoother and they cause a fracture point, right? Mm-hmm. And you usually can see that there's something different about what you're digging in. So
yeah, exactly.
It's just that rock is a lot harder to pick through, which yeah. is why it's going to take till November. So yeah.
So the archaeologists here hope to get a clearer picture of the facial anatomical features, as well as information on brain volume, which tells you how much of the skull they have.
Yeah.
And then different stages of evolution by just kind of fitting this into where it belongs. Mm-hmm. There are also a lot of animal fossils and stone tools found near the skull. That's just like a whole assemblage right there.
Okay.
This is a whole site, you know?
Yep.
And some of the fossils they found were rhinos, elephants, horses, deer, also some carnivores, including leopards, tigers. So somewhat of a typical landscape you would see
yeah.
anywhere else. But now the next thing we're going to mention is something the article goes into. And honestly, I had to do a little bit of research to make sure that there wasn't some miraculous like new technique I didn't know
yeah,
about.
Yeah, totally.
But they mention, and the article, again, it's a translated article from a Chinese newspaper.
Right.
Right? So take that with a grain of salt. I mm-hmm. don't know who translated this, if Google translated it or mm-hmm. if they translated it. I don't know who did. But I feel like this would be hard to get wrong in translation because it's the words that matter. And mm-hmm. the author says that the archaeologist was quoted as saying, "The age of the skull would be further confirmed by radiocarbon dating." Well, let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, let's talk about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so we can get into the specifics of radiocarbon dating, but basically you've got a certain amount every organic thing in the world, trees, plants, yeah. people, it doesn't matter, has a certain amount of radioactive carbon inside of your body, carbon-14. Mm-hmm. And that's taken in by just like eating plants and other animals and stuff like that. You know, there's just the base level amount in things.
Right.
Not really a base level. I shouldn't say that, because now we get into carbon sinks and like fish have more because there's more carbon-14 in the water. Mm-hmm. You got to know what level you're talking about and where you're talking about it. That's why when we do radiocarbon dating, we have uncalibrated dates, which is purely using the half-life of radiocarbon, which is, I think somewhere, I didn't write this down, but it's around 5,500 years, give or take, mm-hmm. which means that half of that radiocarbon is gone in 5,500 years. You're left with half.
Right.
In another 5,500 years, you have a quarter of what you started with. Yeah. So half again. Mm-hmm. Now, that's after you die. Mm-hmm. When the living thing stops being living and stops taking in carbon-14, if you know something else relative about the time period that thing lived in, you can say, okay, so during that time in that area, what was the level of carbon-14 mm-hmm. in the atmosphere? And we have lots of resources to tell us that. Mm-hmm. And then you take that compared to the ratio of the thing that's left in the thing that you found, and you can say, okay, so there's only this many, you know, whatever unit left. Mm-hmm. Therefore, calculating back the half-life, this is 45,000 years old, or right. this is 15,000 years old, or something like that.
Right.
Now, if you look at the half-life of only 5,500 years, you can only go back 60, maybe 70,000 years if you're really sensitive mm-hmm. and you've got a really good sample. Mm-hmm. You certainly can't go back a million years.
No, you definitely cannot.
Yeah.
Which is why it must have been a mistranslation, right? Well, because no archaeologist would say radiocarbon dating in that context by accident, you know?
I feel like the archaeologist may have mentioned a type of dating that the author, yeah. the reporter was unfamiliar with.
Right.
Because they have a completely different sentence, placing this in line with other fossils found. Peking Man is a very famous Homo erectus uh-huh. fossil
yes.
found in China. And they say, new radiocarbon dating pushes the Peking Man fossil back another 800,000 years to over 1.5 million years.
Oh, what? Really?
Yeah, they say that right in the article.
Okay.
So they're not quoting the archaeologist anymore. They're just saying that as a comparison.
They're just saying it wrong because they don't understand. Yeah. It's a journalist not understanding the science and thinking that carbon dating can work for all things.
Right. And this is one of the reasons why we decided a long time ago to start doing news articles on this show.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we didn't used to.
Yep.
And I just feel like reading these with a critical eye and understanding the science behind what you're reading yeah. and you know, being able to see the flaws.
Yeah.
You know,
it may not seem like that big of a deal, like, oh, they got the name of the dating wrong, but it could throw into question the entire article if there's something false here, you know? So
yeah.
you want to distinguish between what's just journalistic accident and what is bad science. And that's kind of hard to say, you know?
And I'm willing to bet the archaeologist got it exactly right.
I'm sure they did.
The reporter got it wrong.
Yeah.
The archaeologist knows what they're talking about.
Yeah. And this article, like, there's great pictures of the excavation. There's even a little video that you can watch where it's dubbed over in English, but where you can, like, get a little bit more information. And, like, it's clearly, like, good archaeology that's going on in the site. It's just the journalism kind of didn't quite do it right.
So real quick, before we end this segment, how do we date these kinds of things?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, we use what's called relative dating because in the end, fossils are just rocks.
Yeah.
And you can't really date your average rock.
Right.
You might be able to say with certain rocks, there are certain rocks actually that you can say this rock was formed this many million years ago.
Right.
Right. Or usually billions of years ago mm-hmm. or hundreds of million years ago.
Like based on the composition, like it must have been at least this long ago to make this rock.
It's not the composition. Well, okay. Although some things, you know, that a certain amount of pressure and time was involved.
Okay.
So you can factor that in. But right. how long ago did that process stop?
Right.
Now, you can't do this with all rock. Volcanic rock, you can do this with. It's again, radioactive dating methods, mm-hmm. but it's using compounds that have a half-life of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of mm-hmm. years. So it takes that long for half of it to go away. So mm-hmm. when you talk about like potassium argon dating on volcanic basalt layers, that's mm-hmm. what we use to date the layers of basalt in Olduvai Gorge where I worked.
Right.
So we didn't know what the dates of the things we were finding were, but we knew that they were between a 2 million year old and a 1.8 million year old layer of basalt that was pretty concretely dated.
And when you're talking that long ago, like 200,000 years, like that's a pretty tight time frame.
Yeah. And with exception, you can generally assume because that 2 million year time frame was also like 3 or 4 meters thick.
Right.
So there was a lot of space there, mm-hmm. 12 feet, 15 feet, right?
Yeah.
Now, you can generally assume that something found at the top of that is more recent than something found at the bottom of that. Mm-hmm. There's always movement with, you know, roots and animals and stuff like that. But you can generally assume that the superposition, it's called, mm-hmm. In geological terms, is true. Mm-hmm. So that's how we date stuff. So there's nothing mentioned here about what they used to relatively date these things, but they definitely did not date the fossils.
Right.
We could say that conclusively.
But it probably is based on a half-life, which is probably how the confusion happened. It's because carbon right. dating is still on a half-life. It's just a much shorter one than these longer potassium, argon, and
yeah.
whatever the other ones use. So.
Two things I can say, if they haven't had time, they will. They will date this based on the morphology or shape of the tools.
Yep.
So those are pretty concrete through time. Mm-hmm. Like if you're holding an iPhone 3G, you know that dates to about the early 2000s.
I think it's like 2009-ish.
Whatever.
That's, so that's not early.
I mean, that's early-ish. But anyway, it's like that, right?
Right.
We have these tools. We know what they look like. And we can generally say, if we found lots of them in other places, that, hey, these generally date to this time frame. So
right.
we can put it in space then. Unless they were early archaeologists mm-hmm. and they were digging up another site.
Right.
The fossils. Yeah, that's not true.
No.
Anyway, so the other thing is the animals. Some of the animals,
oh, yeah.
we mentioned common animal types, but the versions of these animals may be extinct now.
Right.
So we can say, well, we know in other places that this animal went extinct at 800,000 years.
Yeah.
So this has to be older than
it
that.
It has to be older. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So you just try to find stuff that bracket the thing that you found
yeah.
and then you can start dialing in the date.
Yeah. Like you can get a really good date with relative dating and not even have to do any kind of chemical analysis at all. You might need to get a little bit lucky to have enough, you know, different species with mm-hmm. tight extinction time frames and various things like that. But yeah, it can be done with just relative dating.
Yeah. So relative dating, it's not something you should really play with unless you live in the South. Then you can date your relatives. But
oh, God, that was so bad. I didn't even hear that coming. I don't know how you still get me after like 17 years of this.
Well, speaking of playing games, we're going to talk about the ancient Greeks possibly playing a game with their stones back in a minute.
Oh, my God.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 191. And we're talking news stories here. And as I mentioned, we're going to the ancient Greeks and a possible board game. And I just got to preface this. You did the prep for this article. Mm-hmm. Anytime we find a whole bunch of round things, a whole bunch of square things, and they happen to be small, whatever it is, if there's a bunch of them.
It's a game.
It's a game.
Yeah.
And if it's not a game, it's ritual.
Well, you have to kind of see where they're coming from, though, because when you have that, it's like, what else could these possibly have been for?
Yes.
So
yes.
This story is called Stone Spheres Could Be from Ancient Greek Board Game.
Somebody lost their marbles. That's all I got to say. That's the last that's, one. Go on.
Oh my God. That's exactly what they look like, though, except stones. So these stone spheres have been found at sites on Santorini, Crete, Cyprus, and other Greek islands. So it does seem like they're limited to the islands specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know exactly what they were for, of course, which is why this article is fun. So there's a new theory from researchers in Bristol that suggests that these stone spheres might be from an ancient Greek board game. And like you said, it's like, oh, we don't know what these are. Must be a game. But it's a little bit more. There's a little more to the theory than that.
Yeah. Do they have any other examples found near some sort of board, some sort of stone thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that might be coming. So if this is a board game, it would be one of the earliest examples in the archaeological record. And the previous theories about these stones include like a wild variety of things, including sling stones, tossing balls, counting or record keeping systems, and also as counters or pawns.
So that would be for a board game.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so this is a theory, but they're just trying to prove out this specific theory in this study.
Mm-hmm. I like the thought of like being like a record keeping or counting system, because it wouldn't be like a long term record keeping system.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in a multilingual situation, which they more than likely were, being on islands and having a lot of mm-hmm. Mediterranean trade going on.
Right.
Then you might have a way of saying, you know, just putting things on like a grid or just in a shape and saying, I've got this many things, you've got this many things, we're going to put them together, now we have this many things.
Yeah.
And using those as representational pieces, maybe.
That's true. Math is universal, right? And if you can
yeah.
represent it using stones, sure, that would be one way.
People understand quantities. They might know your numbers are, but they understand quantities.
Yeah. Well, that's possible. That's not what this article is about, though. So,
well, that's what my article's about.
Okay, perfect. So the spheres themselves are found in various colors and various materials, and they are generally smaller than a golf ball. So pretty small. Before this study, we knew that there was variability in the size. And the sizes were sort of clustered, like in, like there would be a bunch of them that were similar in size, and it was clustered within a collection of spheres, right? So we knew that there was some kind of intention going on there, but nobody had really like cataloged exactly what all the different sizes were to see what they could have been, basically. Yeah. Now, this new study, it compares 700 of these spherical stones found in the Bronze Age town of Akrotiri. And the town dates to 4,500 to 3,600 before present.
Man.
Yeah. So that's long old. Ago. That's yeah. why this is going to be like one of the most ancient board games, if it's true. There's more work to be done, as yeah. we will talk about. They found, in addition to these spheres, they found stone slabs, like you were hoping. Stone slabs with little cup marks in them that would have perfectly held the stones if they, like, set them in there.
A certain number of stones, presumably, because they're defined sizes.
Yeah, when you look at the images of the slabs, it's in the article. This is a fizz.org article, and it's really well done, as those articles always are. And you can see the images where they really brought out those cup shapes, and like they're kind of roughly like round in shape. One of them looked a little bit more horseshoe kind of shaped. So it definitely does seem like they're intentional little pockmarks. So they had a reason.
If they could just radiocarbon date these rock stones, then we would know exactly how old they are.
Wow.
Yeah. Did you guys learn everything? Yeah. That was your pop quiz for this episode.
Uh-huh. I hope you're making they're making fun of you right now.
That's right.
Yeah. The most important thing they found is that overall the spheres break into two categories. One is a smaller category, and then the second is a larger category. Mm-hmm. Rather than being clustered in a bunch of different sizes, they kind of break into the smaller and larger. And that's great. And that's sort of like, that's like the end of the research for this article, basically, is like, look how these stones break out into these different chunks. And look, we have these boards that have some holes in them. So, but they're very candid about that in the article. They say the next step is to basically measure all the cup marks on the boards and see if they break out into a similar pattern with a smaller and a larger cup size that you could put these smaller and larger stones in.
Right. The crazy thing about writing papers, especially ones that end up in like popular journals like fizz.org, it's just it's interesting how the step-by-step process here. You got to kind of look at this a little bit, too. Like, this is a pretty rudimentary stage of this analysis, but you know they've already analyzed the holes by the time they wrote this article.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Just looking at them, they can probably say, look, they're different sizes.
Yeah.
But, and again, looking at why these articles are written and kind of using your own intuition to say what you know about that, what this tells me is that these are people that are still trying to maintain tenure or trying to get tenure, because the number of publications you have actually matters.
Yeah, they do.
So instead of waiting 2 years and writing one huge, you know, monograph or paper, which is probably, you know, better for the science because it's all in one spot.
It's all together,
You're going to break this up into 10 different papers. You're going to write one every 2 months.
Yeah.
And you already know everything. They probably did all the research in a really short period of time.
Yeah.
And they're just doling this out. But not to say that that's bad.
Yeah.
You know, put it out there in little chunks, and people can, if they've got something along the way, they can say, hey, I found this kind of thing too, and contact the researchers.
Well, I think it might be good to kind of pause yourself mentally in the middle of a large, like, quantitative study like this, where they're just measuring stuff, right? Like, that's what this is. They're just taking their little calipers and they're measuring the diameter of these balls, right? And maybe some other characteristics.
Yeah.
And I think you might need to take a step back from that. Like, well, it's probably their students that are doing it, but whatever, you gotta take a step back from that and try to like assign some conclusions to what you're seeing, so that when you move forward to the next phase, which in this case would be the board cup measurements, you have a clear view of what you just learned in the past, you know, chunk of research that you did. So I think that in that case, breaking it up into pieces does kind of make sense. And the other thing that I think is interesting here too is that while they knew that these different spheres were clustering into groups of sizes, you know, they didn't really realize that it was mostly split into two different sizes. You just can't see that with your eyeballs. You need statistics to tell you that you're seeing, like, mostly, you know, half of it is about this size and half of it are in this size range. You know, mm-hmm. you just really need the measurements and then the statistics that comes with it to tell you those sorts of things.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that, too, is, well, first off, these are 7,000 years old. Mm-hmm. So who knows what kind of erosion or abuse they went through, you know, since yeah. they've been in the ground and yeah. how much have been knocked off of these things.
Yeah.
And also where they, I'd like to see how the sizes broke out, too. Like, is there a table of sizes that are belonged with this? Because it would be interesting to me to see, like, where did they decided small and large? Mm-hmm. But realistically, maybe there was lots of them missing and there's small, medium, and large. Mm-hmm. And there's three sizes, there's four sizes, something like that. It'd be interesting to see because these people who knew nothing about what these were for decided that there was a measurement at which they would cut off small and start yeah. calling it large.
Yeah.
They had to define that themselves.
Right.
So
is there like a gap between those two sizes where you see none, you know?
Yeah, is it a measurable gap, so to speak?
But like, I doubt it, you know? Yeah.
Well, I would imagine they came up with something that was definable like that mm-hmm. and said, okay, this looks like a good breakpoint.
Yeah.
You know? So,
okay, really quick, I'm going to make one like mid podcast correction so that I don't have to try to like correct this in editing. I said 4,500 to 3,600 BP in my notes by accident, but it's actually years ago. So,
oh, I see.
So that brings it forward by what, 2,000 years or something like that
yeah,
when you
yeah.
say when yeah. you say it like that.
Okay, instead. So before present,
yes.
So 2,000 BCE.
Yeah,
give or
years
take.
Ago, not yeah.
yeah. Yeah, BCE, but BP is years ago, before present.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I'm still mixing this up.
No, we got it.
Okay.
We got it. All right.
Yeah. All right. Well, one last thing on this article, which I thought was interesting, and it's the whole reason that they're studying it, is what are the implications here? You mm-hmm. know, what does this mean about a Bronze Age society? And they're using this as a way to show that this indicates that there's social interaction happening on a like pretty complicated level with this game concept yeah. being passed amongst people in a community, and also that they had free time in order to play this game.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was just the kids. Who knows? Kids, adults. Can't really say
sure.
in this context, but both of those things I thought were interesting because you just don't get a little peek into prehistoric societies very much
mm-hmm.
as far as that kind of stuff goes. So yeah.
Yeah. And they were at a time when they were well along their way of city states and things like that, where, you know, people kind of had jobs
mm-hmm.
and they did have free time
mm-hmm.
versus Uber like prehistoric times when, I mean, sure, you had a lot of downtime after the kill and you guys are just all fat and happy and sitting on the savannah. But eventually there's a saber-toothed tiger coming around the corner
right.
or a rival tribe.
Right.
You know, so anyway, so these scientists still have some measuring to do and they still have some explaining to do, so to speak, as far as their measurements go. But you know who doesn't have any explaining to do? Viking women, because they knew exactly what their measurements were in order to get paid. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 191. And as I alluded to at the last segment, we're going to talk about Viking women. Now, we had to talk about this one because it's been a few weeks since we did a news episode.
Yeah.
And it's literally everywhere.
It is.
# Scientific American.
And also, I'm like fiber lady, right? I love everything fiber related.
You were going to talk about it anyway, but the thing I think is cool, before we even get into this, is that this is about Vikings. It's really about archaeology
yeah.
and history. And it's the cover story
of
Scientific yeah. American for, I think, September, maybe October.
I think
you
it was
how
September.
Issues work. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, super cool.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that it was prominent enough to make that.
Yeah. And it was actually really good timing because we just interviewed in episode 189 the Lady Sapiens director, Thomas Sirotu. And he was basically talking about how past archaeologists had these preconceived notions of women in ancient civilizations and what they did and what their roles were. And this is a perfect example of archaeologists not really caring about or paying attention to something that was just women's work, you know?
I'd love to see his reaction when he first saw this article. He'd be like, ha, told you.
I know. And then he'd be like, Lady Sapiens 2. Here we go.
The Viking edition.
Right. So over the years, Viking women have been portrayed as primarily domestic workers, which I think is mostly accurate for them, too. They have often been sexualized in pop culture and movies and things like that. And most recently in the show Vikings, and there's another one that came out recently, Northmen or something like that. And what they did is they kind of flipped the script a little bit and made them shield maidens and like lady warriors, right? And I'm sure there's like aspects of all of that that made up the Viking women. But the truth is always somewhere in the middle, right? Like, yeah, I'm sure there were some warriors, and there have been some graves that through DNA evidence they figured out were actually women, even though everything buried with them was warrior stuff.
Well, and we have to remember too that Vikings were popularized in popular movies and fiction for at least the last 100 years,
yeah,
or more.
Yeah.
And especially when Hollywood came out, we talked about this. We had a whole Vikings episode a while back.
Yep.
And like the whole image of them with horns and like they never did that.
No,
there's nothing in the archaeological record.
Yeah.
Of them wearing a helmet with horns on it.
It was made up by entertainers.
Right.
And now it's just like part of what people think of when they think of,
yeah,
Vikings.
So Vikings were, I mean, they were really kind of like, not kind of, they were the historic ancestors of the Danish people, for one thing.
Yeah.
But also other people around there, you mm-hmm. know, and what became that whole area. But, you know, they're just people that, yeah, sure, I'm sure they marauded. I'm sure they raped a little bit, and I'm sure they killed a little bit.
Yeah, they stole a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and they also had families and villages,
yeah,
and
they had
people
to survive.
They were supporting.
They were in the north, you know, Atlantic. It was very cold up there. And you know what they had to do? Weave some warm clothes.
That's exactly right.
And we know that women were the primary weavers in the Viking culture. So what's going on here, and what the Scientific American article really focused on, was one researcher, Michelle Heyer Smith. She's an anthropological archaeologist at Brown University, and she's been studying not just the cloth that was produced by women, but also trying to use it to draw conclusions about women, the role of women, and like who they were in the society itself.
Yeah.
She calls it social archaeology, which
of course she does.
I really love that terminology. I think it's great. This article is the perfect example of somebody taking those, like, the daily drudgery of measuring things and weighing things and taking close-up photos of things and all of that stuff that makes archaeology kind of a drag sometimes, but taking all of that data and coming up with real, live, cool conclusions that are kind of irrefutable. It's just so cool.
Right. But I got to pause right there, because
okay,
that's when archaeology becomes anthropology, the study of humans.
It is. And that's why she's an anthropological archaeologist. That's her
Everyone
title.
Everyone is an anthropological archaeologist. I'm so irritated by that. I mean, good on her, but in social archaeology, it's awesome to like coin a phrase, but also just anthropology.
Ugh, don't be such a hater. I think it's amazing.
So anyway, what is it? Who is it that said it? It was archaeology is anthropology or is nothing?
Yeah. Oh,
Ian
right.
Hotter?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're getting into theory, guys. Don't turn off or unsubscribe.
No.
Please.
And we're going to move away from that quickly and get into the nitty gritty of measuring tiny pieces of cloth. So
listen, go
here
to the
go.
Midwest United States, spend $85, get an anthropology degree, and you'll know what we're talking about. So
you've insulted Southerners and also Midwesterners. Who else would you like to
All
insult
anthropologists
today?
And archaeologists as well.
You are the worst.
But not the Vikings.
Oh, no, we wouldn't want to insult them.
No.
I mean, they might come after you with an axe or something. So,
oh my god, so many wrong things in this podcast.
I'm talking about the historical ones, not current Vikings, if they even are like Vikings anymore.
You mean like movie Vikings?
Yeah, those ones.
Now we know a Viking friend. She's Danish. She's definitely a Viking.
She's not a Viking. Oh my gosh.
She would have been a shield maiden.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, moving on. I might edit some of that out. So Heyer Smith focused on the everyday homespun cloth, which has been really neglected by researchers in the past. They just see these brown scraps of dirty fabric.
More cloth.
And just sort of probably catalog that it's there and then move on and don't do anything with it.
Yeah.
But she really got into it. She measured the fiber diameter of the fibers that make up the cloth itself, and then the size of the cloth and the patterning on the cloth and just all of the tiny details that you can think of when talking about cloth. And I have some experience weaving, so I'm not going to like bore you with all of that. But just suffice it to say that there is a lot of different ways to make woven cloth. And she documented every single version of that she saw. I'm sure it's probably hundreds.
I can't remember, but did the article say whether she had a lot to work from, or is these cloth samples like somewhat rare, or is it just like lots? Because it says she measured this in Iceland, Greenland, the Faroes, Scotland, Norway, museum collections all over the place. But like, how much are we talking about here? Enough to really do something with, apparently.
There was one sample collection that was like 150 different pieces, mm-hmm. which is kind of a lot for a organic material that tends to degrade. But I think it was actually much more than that. That was just what she used for that one particular sample type.
I'll bet she looked at the yarn to see if it was a Z or an S-spin. That's what I would know. I would love to know that personally.
So we've totally talked about Z and S spin yarn before on this podcast, but hey, let's talk about it again because I love it. So
did you also talk about it on season one of the Historical Yarns podcast?
I probably did.
Check that out. It's still available. Historical Yarns.
I'm not even going to say that season two is coming because it's just dormant over here right in this corner.
And then somebody go to one of those petition sites and start something to get Rachel to do a season two.
Oh, maybe someday.
Yeah.
So the direction of the yarn can be described as either Z or S. And that has to do, because when you look at a piece of yarn, you will see that the different plies that make up that piece of yarn are twisted one way or another way. And the Z way is kind of like slanting down to the left, and the S way is slanting like down to the right. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to visualize, but they have a really great graphic of it in the article. So it's definitely worth taking a quick look at.
It's pretty obvious if you know what you're looking for.
Yeah. Now, just a quick history of like Viking weaving in general. They have been weaving warm cloth, obviously, North Atlantic, for thousands of years just to survive the temperatures up there. And the original method, and this method continued through medieval times, I believe. It's a warp weighted loom, and they originally had these small weaving houses called dingia. And warp weighted looms, just really quickly, are when you see a floor loom, it's sort of like flat and somebody is weaving back and forth using the arms going back and forth across something that is like flat in front of them, right?
I saw one of those in our storage unit. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yes, I do have one in our storage unit. Don't throw shade on me about it. Someday we'll have a house again and I'll get it out and I'll use it. Be quiet. So that's like your kind of standard way of weaving today, right?
Yeah.
And what these ladies did back in, you know, pre-medieval Viking times and even through medieval times is they used this warp-weighted loom, which was, I don't quite understand exactly how it worked, but it involved hanging the warp and using large rocks at the bottom to tie. They tied them onto the warp threads, and that would add weight to it. So then they would have a rod in between, like every other thread, to separate them. So then they could they could bring the weft thread through. That's not a great explanation. It's really hard to visualize it.
Yeah.
Again, go to the article. There's a couple good views of what it looked like, but anyway, the dingia are pit houses, and they had a stone hearth for warmth in a corner, and they could like comfortably fit 2 to 3 weavers maybe and the loom in there for working. So it was kind of this like small enclosed, like very female centric space. They're usually pre 1000 CE. And they were generally spaces that were shunned by men. We know this from the Icelandic sagas that were written about the time. Now, this is people writing them hundreds of years after this happened. So it's like through that lens of looking backwards in time. But you can guess that it's somewhat accurate that it was just not a place that men went to.
I mean, does that mean they were shunned or did they just not need to go there?
Well, it was like an insult, right?
For a man to go into a woman's work area?
Yeah, kind of. Like there's one, and it's quoted in the article, about female Valkyries using the intestines of the men that they killed to go into their little dingia loom weaving pit house and then weave their intestines into cloth.
That sounds warm.
For whatever purpose. So there's a lot of mythology around the weaving process being kind of bad, and because it was associated with women, it was just like this men did not associate with the women's work of weaving. So now, sometime in the medieval era, there was a shift from this small separate weaving space. It was brought inside into the medieval longhouse called a scholy. And I think there had been speculation as to why that happened, but we didn't really know. We thought maybe like there was more of an industry around weaving that happened in that time. But Hayter Smith she's out to prove this, that is exactly what happened. So that's part of what she's doing here.
as you mentioned, there were a lot of examples of this.
Yeah.
And as she was measuring these cloth fragments from across a pretty good span of time, this is again, this pre-medieval period.
Yeah.
So for a really long time, she noticed a trend in the cloth, and the pre-medieval cloth was varied and colorful.
Yeah.
Individual really to the weavers.
Yeah.
And maybe to their families, right?
In the region and the community and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So when did it become more standardized?
Yeah. So in medieval times, the cloth becomes more standard. It's called legal cloth or Valmal.
V-A-O with a little thing on it. M-A with a little thing on it. L.
Right. So Valmal seems right. The right pronunciation. In the 11th century, cloth shifted to almost a tight range of 4 to 15 warp threads, and the fiber shifted to almost entirely espun. And both of those things are characteristics of this Valmal legal cloth. And the reason it's called legal cloth is because it is cloth that fits the legal definition from these medieval law books that we had. And Hayter Smith, you know, she went and looked at translations of these books to confirm what she was seeing. And basically, this Valmal had a definition in these medieval law books. There is a currency amount applied to a certain amount of this Valmal cloth in these books. So because it almost makes the cloth equate to currency in this culture, in this place.
Well, it sounds like this society that was, again, you know, if men were not wanting to go in there because it was an insult, but they didn't really understand what was going on in there either. And then, you know, perhaps some people were, I'm sure this came around because this cloth was being sold, obviously. Mm-hmm. People had to buy stuff unless they had somebody to make it themselves. And anytime you have a society that is coming up and trying to standardize things and figure stuff out, they determined that a certain specification, a measurement, was equated to a certain amount of silver. And so since everybody wants to get paid, the individuality left and the standardization entered.
And normally I would say, oh, it's so sad. They lost all that individuality that they had before. But what is so interesting about this is that it stopped being this like immediate family use or even small community use and became a commodity that was an industry that they could use to make a lot of money. I'm sure if they got really, really good at this weaving process and they got really fast at it and it became, you know, a special focus of this family group or whatever, it's probably why the loom moved into the Scully, right? So it's in their house with them now.
Yeah.
Everybody's participating. It is the thing that is making the money for the family. But it sounds like there's not any evidence that the industry also shifted to men at this time. It sounds like it was still very women driven. Mm-hmm. And the women were the one who were making the cloth and making the decisions about the business. That might not necessarily be true because I don't really know how we could say who's making the business decisions in a house where cloth is being created if men and women are both involved. But it does seem like it gave women more status, which is a very cool evolution of the cloth making process.
Did they mention in the article whether or not it was, I don't know if illegal is the right word, but illegal or frowned upon to sell the more individualistic pieces? Because I would assume, like in all time periods, anytime you have somebody who is of a higher status, they want something that's unique.
No. And so that's one thing to keep in mind here is that the cloth that she's measuring for this study and the cloth that counts for this legal cloth is your basic homespun.
Okay.
It's the kind of cloth that
your everyday cloth.
Yeah. Everyday people are buying to make clothes with or whatever. There's plenty of high, you know,
special stuff.
Special, you know, various different purposes for other reasons that were happening. And there's probably like lower level cloth too for things that just didn't need to be clothing level. So, but this is your basic homespun.
Okay.
So another really interesting thing is that while she's studying all these different collections of homespun fabric across the North Atlantic, she found that the one place where it didn't fit into this like medieval standard cloth thing was Greenland. So Greenland is not a place that has had a lot of people living in it, but the Viking colonies that they have the archaeological remains for were the descendants of Eric the Red, and they were sent away. They were convicted for some reason. Or Eric the Red, he was convicted for some reason and sent away. And these are the people that followed him and went with him when he was when he was sent away to Greenland. So the descendants of those people who were the Greenland colonies, they created a totally different type of fabric. And it's a weft-dominated cloth. Which we don't even need to go into the specifics of that. It basically just means that there's more weft threads and it has a more horizontal line look to it rather than vertical. But it really doesn't matter. The point is that they did that. And part of the reason is because it makes a very, very warm cloth, like much warmer than what was being made by the other method. And the hypothesis here is that they needed warmer cloth in Greenland, obviously, very far north. But also, it was a reaction to climate change that was happening.
Yeah.
So there was big global warming that happened around, like, 1340, I think.
Yeah, it's called the medieval warming period.
Yeah, exactly. And we've known about that, obviously, and we've seen that.
It impacted the entire planet.
Yeah. And what Hayter Smith here wanted to show is that the shift in Greenland from the original style of cloth making to this weft dominated cloth happened in conjunction with global warming, as if they were trying to make warmer cloth. And she did show that, because the shift happened around 1340 in the early 1300s, and by 1360 it had fully shifted. So right at the same time that climate change was happening, and they stayed that way until the colony was abandoned sometime in the 1400s. So definitely is like specific evidence that they changed their cloth making process in response to climate change.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah. Very neat.
And I'd just like to point out a little bit about Greenland because recently, I don't know why I did this, but recently I did a little bit of a deep dive on maps. Like, I just kind of like look on maps on my
phone.
That's
like a thing you do.
It is a thing I do.
Like, if you're not watching weather videos at night before bed, you're just like scrolling around on maps.
I'm just looking at the satellite.
Looking at the world.
I did Kazakhstan not too long ago. I just wanted to check that out a little bit. But then I did Greenland not too long ago, too. And I'm just like, Greenland, people really only live along the coast.
Yeah.
And I went and looked, and there's definitely villages. And one thing I always look for in these really far off crazy places when I'm on maps is like, what's their coffee shop situation?
Oh my God.
And so I zoomed in. Probably the only thing they had was a Subway, because I learned recently that there are Subways literally everywhere. It's the most populous fast food chain on the planet.
I don't know what that means.
That's insane.
I'm like a little concerned about that.
But just pulling up some data real quick, there is a 2022 estimate, because I don't think the recording is very good in Greenland, of 56,000 people living there.
Oh wow, that's actually today. More than I would expect. But, you know, people live everywhere these days.
They do, because you can fly in there. You can boat in there. You can get there in a number of ways. Now, I don't know if, like, I can jump on American right now and book a flight to Greenland. But
it might be pretty expensive.
Yeah.
But
so anyway.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, one last thing here, because you might be wondering, why did this fabric only last in this tight time frame from like the 1100s-ish to the 1500s-ish? And the reason is basically political change and kind of progress to the country. So politically speaking, I think it was a Norwegian monarchy sort of was in a down period at that time, and the Danish kings were kind of in control of the whole area, and the Danish just, they were more interested in promoting the English style of cloth weaving, which was using a floor loom. Right. And as it turned out, it was a much faster way of creating cloth. Anyway, it's totally different. And you actually, using a floor loom, you could make the same stuff that they made, the Vikings made. But anyway, it just sort of transitioned because it was faster, it was cheaper, and you know how industry is. It's capitalism, but like 500, 600 years ago, right? Like, you switch to the faster and more efficient method. So that's kind of what happened. And there's still examples of it later into the historic record, but they pretty much die out by like the 17, 1800s. And you just don't see that anymore. So, yeah.
And the regulated fabric started again around 1000 CE or so.
That's when we see the first medieval law books. That was more like in the 1200s. But
well, that happens to coincide roughly, very roughly, with when Denmark and Norway got Bluetooth. So,
right.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That would be the king, right?
Harold Bluetooth.
Yeah.
I had to look it up. So, and no, his reign ended in Denmark in 986. So I don't know if he had much to do with the laws that were coming around at that time.
I don't think so. I think this is going on a little later than that.
But just for people that don't know, the people who invented Bluetooth, I think it was invented in Norway or Denmark. One of the two.
And that's why they called it Bluetooth.
For whatever reason, I don't know why, but they came up with this. And that's the symbol for Bluetooth, that little jagged line, is to symbolize his teeth.
No way. Yeah, I did not know that. That's so... Wow, he had some really janky teeth, didn't he?
Apparently. I don't know. So I don't know much more about it beyond that.
Oh, that's crazy.
It just goes to show that when you get technology like Bluetooth, everything changes. So I don't know.
Well... That is a way to end this podcast.
It is indeed. So we hope to have, again, some episodes coming up about our travels, because we just happen to be right now going to a bunch of really cool, interesting places.
Yeah.
We were in Great Basin National Park, which, living in Nevada for 12 years, we'd never been to, because it's literally the hardest thing to get to in the whole state. Mm-hmm. And... It's just so out of the way.
It is.
And
it's amazing, though.
It's great. Yeah. So we'll talk about that. We'll probably talk about Zion. We've been here for a few days.
Yeah. And I really have a bone to pick with all of the alt trails reviewers about Zion, because there's a trail here called the Archaeology Trail, and the reviews of it are like, boring, skip it, don't do it. And I am like ready to get on my soapbox and defend this trail. So
I feel like I've heard those reviews about this podcast. So,
well, that's fine. For anybody who doesn't think that stuff is boring, rant about all trails reviews coming on our next podcast. Probably
anybody listening to this doesn't think that stuff is boring. So,
right.
Totally. Yeah. So anyway, we're doing that, and we're actually leaving tomorrow as we're recording this. So you don't know when that is in time, but as we're recording this, and we're headed to Monument Valley, which is in Navajo country.
Yes.
It's in the Navajo Nation land. Mm-hmm. So that'll be really cool.
Yep. Definitely.
Yep. All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to get back on the road and find some more archaeology.
Definitely.
See you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster and Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.